Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 11th, 2005. This session is Take Off Your Shoes, From Awe to Holy, presented by Rabbi Robert Marks in the Fireside Room. Disc number MAR-2005-06. Let's listen in.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam. Asher kedeshanu b'mitzvotav v'tivadu la'asok b'divrei Torah. Bless you, O God. Sanctify your name. Who has commanded us to study Torah. Amen. Amen. I'd like to start that prayer at the beginning of the week. Beginning of a week of study. Because during the times that I've been up here, precious few times, but they have been precious times indeed. The study of God's Word has become indeed a very holy thing. And a thing for which I, in my tradition, can only praise by saying thank you. Baruch atah Adonai, beginning of most Hebrew blessings, is not to ask God for something, not to talk about how we are or how in need we are, but to say thank you, God, for this opportunity of all of us to gather together and to pursue a truth together. In a remarkable article that appeared about 20 years ago, a very Orthodox rabbi by the name of Joseph Soloveitchik, who lived in Boston, wrote an article about the lonely man of faith, using, of course, gender and sensitive terms, but a magnificent idea. Soloveitchik suggested that in God's act of creation, there were really two human beings. There were really two types of personalities. And in talking about Moses and the burning bush, and the taking off of the sandals, one realizes that Moses too experienced a change, many changes. Soloveitchik takes the first two chapters of Genesis. Now, this is a group that I do not need to remind the contents of Genesis. You know that in the first chapter, what happens? Fans, everybody, anybody, what happens in the first chapter? What? Creation, okay. Second chapter, what happens? Creation again, right? All right. What happens in the first chapter? What specific creation of, what's the thing we're most interested in if we're self-centered and egocentric the way I am? Creation of man at the end of the process. In this course, I often have used the word midrash to explain the process which I very often use to find the meaning of ideas in the Bible. And I find periodically, since there are people who have joined me for the first time, that it's useful to explain that Midrash simply means teaching, the commentary, the teachings. When you pastors give a sermon, you might like a particular idea that explains a text. Somebody could be in your audience who's a book editor, a compiler, a student of yours. And he says, you know, I like that idea. I'm going to write it down and then publish it with a lot of other ideas and discussions of that chapter of the Bible. That becomes midrash. We use that, those midrashim, plural, the teachings, and the commentaries of a lot of bright people over the centuries, in order to really mine a text that is there. And that's what Saul Bechik was doing with the first two chapters of Genesis. And he noticed something very interesting about them. He noticed that in the first chapter of Genesis, that all the things of nature are created. Now, he was also aware of a very old midrash that noticed the omission of something. That when God created the trees, God said it was good. When God created the sun and the moon, the commentary is, it was good. On the sixth day, human beings are created. And it doesn't say it was good. Never noticed that? Didn't say it. Very simple thing. The omission of it was good. So I'm a midrashist. How would I deal with that? What do I do? Now, this is a Soloveitchik, and it isn't Marx. It's very, very old, because somebody reading that passage, 2,000 years ago, noticed that omission. How would you deal with it? What would you do? If you're suddenly reading your Bible and you see, well, the fish, it was good. God saw that it was good. Animals of the field, God saw that it was good. Sun, moon, and stars, God saw that it was good. Man, mum. Mum. I'm not going to let you sit there passively. You're going to have to tell me, somebody, how would you deal with it? How do you explain that? Why?
I'd say there's some ambiguity there. That the.
Very good, Peter. Ambiguity is a good word to avoid making a decision.
that the human is perhaps going to be in a separate category, and maybe there's something even profound there about looking into the future, about evil, about problems, about being inconsistent with the rest of good creation, and also with regard to human beings being capable of consciousness.
Now, that's very good. I think you ought to become a minister. I think that's what you're going to do. See, but that's very good. But notice what you've said. I'm not kidding you. I'm being very serious. There are about three or four sermons in what you've just said. I mean, you bundled them all together, but there's some wonderful ideas in that answer. What else? Anyone else want to?
He gave man their own will.
Man, good, very good. Very good. Gave human beings their own will. Okay, what else?
Well, it's at the very end of Genesis 1, it says that God saw all that he created and said it was good.
Oh, okay. Well, you're spoiling my story. No, you're absolutely right. When at the end of it, bundled together, God says, and he saw everything he did. So that could include man, right? If we want to be generous. Okay, but that's another midrash, though. You know, in other words, why then after everything is a good? But why? I saw another. So you're absolutely right. Okay,
over here. I was going to say the same thing.
You were going to say it. You're reading. See, you guys are reading the text, and right? You're reading. Yeah, back there.
Well, because he gave man free will, he doesn't know the end of the story. It's our choice.
You know what? That's the midrash. That's the famous midrash, and that's very good. Because what the rabbis like to say was, there's sort of a predeterminism in this world. You know, that fish don't have any will of their own, really. I think we're beginning to maybe question a little bit of that. But certainly trees and the stars, they're there. But the uniqueness of human beings is what you've all been saying. That we have the ability to do good or evil. We have the ability to take that creation and do something with it. Now, believe it or not, I'm talking about Moses, too, because it affects the story of the burning bush. But the midrash that Saul of Egypt was aware of was that old midrash that said, all of these acts of creation, they're objects in nature. Even the animals he felt, or science felt, they don't have free will. They have instincts. They have impulses. But what human beings have in distinctive abundance is free will. In other words, we can determine whether our lives will be good or not good. Are they good? Are they not good? That's up to us. Now, in his sort of epic article, because what Joseph Soloveitchik, as an Orthodox rabbi, was doing, was saying that the Bible can be read creatively. It doesn't need to be read literally, word by word. There are ideas there that can be explored. And the ideas in Genesis are that the first Adam that is created is told to subdue and conquer. And the second Adam is told that he's got to give up his rib and woman, Eve, is created. For Soloveitchik, the lonely man of faith, lonely woman of faith, is the one who gives up, who gives something, who gives away. The first man, he said, is the manufacturer, the man of the 20th century. He lived in the 20th century. The man of the 20th century. The man who's acquiring things. Subdue, conquer. Your owner, you shall have dominion over things. The second Adam is the replenisher, the preserver, the one who gives to other people, who gives his very body, a very Christian idea, if you wanted to adapt it even further, who gives himself to other people. And I'm saying that's what happens to Moses. Tomorrow, I'm going to try to deal with something very difficult. And that is what Moses found as he identified himself with God and what types of God there are that people can believe in or not believe in. And I'm glad you're leaving today, so many of you, because I will undoubtedly offend a lot of people tomorrow as I attempt to parse the ideas of God. But we're not ready for that yet. Instead, we're going to parse Moses, in a sense, as he comes to God. Because Moses has had so many lives. He's doubly alienated. He's alienated from his own people, and he's alienated from the Egyptians. We find him in a wilderness. And the wilderness is more than a symbolic wilderness. He's taking care of sheep. He has been denuded of everything physical. all the comforts of his life, he's out in the wilderness, takes off his shoes, and stands lonely before God. Now, our reader, please, if you will, because you are not here just to be a pretty orderly. Okay. Please read, Moses is bidden.
Moses is bidden to remove his sandals. The Hebrew is in the plural. Why both? Whereas in another instance, Joshua is commanded to remove only a sandal, singular Josh 5:15. One shoe is the body, the other is the human soul.
Notice the mysticism. This is not a rational interpretation. This is a mystical interpretation. The shoes mean something. One shoes the body, one shoes the soul. Here you're getting a dualism, a body and soul. The philosophers here, there's a sort of Platonic dualism that's to be found in this passage, which is by a medieval commentary. This is Malbim was a rabbi in the Middle Ages, and he's talking about the mystic. There's a Platonism here of the body and soul, and so one shoe is the body. Now he's going to go point out a little further what's going on. Go ahead.
Hence, in commanding Joshua to remove his shoe, God meant to tell him, if you wish to understand the ways of God and reach the level at which you will be able to behold me, you must first cast off the urges of the body that conceal the spirit within. But to Moses, whose perception was so great that he might penetrate the inner chambers, God commanded that he divest himself not only of his physical urges, but, so to speak, of his spirit as well. Therefore, he was to remove both sandals. Only then would God reveal himself to Moses.
Okay. So Moses is in a sense, by even the use of the word shoes as opposed to shoe, sandals as opposed to sandal, the plural is something that you pick up. There's just the addition of the plural idea gives you something different, that it's both body and spirit. Now, Moses stands before the burning bush, and I want to read that passage because it is the very essence of our whole summer together, of this whole summer together. Would you please turn to Exodus chapter 3, please, in your Bibles. Go ahead. You sure do need it. I have my reader. How can you read without a Bible? Yes, I need it. Bible course without Bibles. I want posterity to hear this. I want this recorded for all time. The scene now, if the video cameras were on, would be thousands of people scurrying for Bibles. Including the Bible reader. I love this place. This is love. It is living drama. That's right. I don't care about the translations. I care about the essence.
Spanish.
Spanish. Well, I didn't get that one. Mine's in English. Okay, here we go.
I trust you
to
begin.
Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called him out of the bush. Moses, Moses, he said, here I am. Then he said, "Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground."
That's the theme of our summer. The place on which we're standing is holy ground. Now, we could become maudlin, of course, and we would be correct and say, this place is holy, this is holy ground. And it is clear that when we come here, when any of us come here, we are leaving places of noise and coming to a place where we could try to listen first to one another and then to God. No matter how you describe it, and no matter how many tensions there are in a huge community like this living together, there is something holy. There's something different about this place. And in order to approach the whole idea, we have to understand what Moses came from. He came, first of all, from the city. Came from the palace of Pharaoh. He came from a life in which holy was not part of his vocabulary. He came from a society in which he was born as a Jew, born into a time of danger, in which his family dared not raise him and even put him in the Nile River with a family eagerly watching what would happen, which he was rescued by the daughter of Pharaoh herself and brought up as an Egyptian. Moses has no sense of being anything special. You have to realize that. He was not Moses, he was Moses. He was a little kid. And he had everything he wanted. He was brought up in the royal household. If you stop and think about I'm not sure I know Moses. I've lived with Moses for 55 years as a rabbi, and I don't know Moses. I don't know Moses. I mean, he's an object. And what the Midrash and tradition try to do is make him a human being. Now, how do you do that? Well, first of all, there have to be traditions that sort of point to the fact that Moses is going to be something special. You remember, those of you who were with us before, that Moses, growing up in the royal palace, treated like a little prince, is so beautiful and so well-liked, according to the Midrash, not according to the Bible, that the magicians of Pharaoh become jealous of him. They say, this kid's going to take over the throne. This kid, Pharaoh, is a threat to you. We've got to put him to the... And there, as you'll remember, miraculously, God has placed Moses' future father-in-law. Now, I don't know how many father-in-laws come to their son-in-law's brises, circumcisions, but there was Jethro sitting there with this little toddler playing. And what was Jethro, a priest of Midian, doing down there in Egypt, watching Moses grow up? But anyhow, God places very conveniently in this Midrash Jethro, the future father-in-law of Moses, there. And Jethro comes up with this ingenious plan. He says, well, don't kill Moses the way the magicians want to do. Rather put a crown here and burning coals there and see which one the kid reaches for. If he takes the crown, you'll know he's a usurper and a danger to the throne. If he reaches for the coals, you'll know he's safe. Little kid Moses is there, according to the Midrash. Not according to the Bible. I'm emphasizing the Midrash. He's sitting there, and an angel comes down as Moses is reaching for the crown. After all, it's shiny and beautiful. He wants the crown. There it is. What's to play with it? My little granddaughter likes to make crowns and put them on her head. She loves them. She's my princess. She puts crowns on her head. And the angel Gabriel grabs Moses' hand, puts it on the hot coal. Moses puts the burning finger in his mouth, and therefore, ever after, he's slow of speech. That explains the later biblical passage that Moses says, "I'm slow of speech." Moses lisps because of this accident. But obviously the effort of the Midrash is to humanize this Moses, who simply grows up and one day, according to the Bible, sees an Egyptian taskmaster beating a Hebrew slave. And Moses looks this way and looks that, and because nobody's looking, he kills the taskmaster. Now his life begins with an act of violence. His religious life begins with an act of violence. What sort of thing is that for the great leader? I mean, how many great religious leaders begin with a murder? That's a problem. Moses has done this, so the commentaries try to make all sorts of excuses that the man was on the point of death, therefore it was justified. And even one Midrash says Moses consulted with the heavenly court before he did it. That's not the Bible. That's the commentary. In order to make Moses a human being, so Moses can do that. But it's quite clear by now that Moses' life is over. Stop and think about it. He's a murderer on the run. Of course, we may ask why the prince of Egypt couldn't kill anybody he wanted to kill. If he was really a prince in Egypt, he would have absolute power. But somehow or other, for the sake of the Bible and for the sake of history, Moses is now estranged from everybody. Nobody. I mean, he can't go back to Egypt. He can't go back to his own people who say, you know, the next day you're going to do to us what you did with... You remember that passage in Exodus where the Hebrews now are afraid of Moses. They're afraid he's going to be a murderer. He must have been a very awesome man. I think he was an awesome man all his life. He was not the guy you're going to have over for dinner. He's not going to be your best friend. He's an awesome... And what does he do? He goes to his own Holden village up in the mountains. He has to get away. Goes up to the mountains. And there he meditates and gets ready to meet his God. Now, I want to sort of pause in the middle of all of this to do something I threatened to do last week, and I've not done it. And that's to ask the question, what role do the shoes themselves play in this process? Because it is the sandals. And after all, the theme of your summer is take off your shoes. Mm-hmm. What role do that? So I'm going to ask you to take a look, please, if you will, at Deuteronomy 25. Because I want to see shoes in a different context. Here we've seen Moses taking off his shoes. Now look at Deuteronomy 25, and you'll see shoes in an entirely different context. And it's a passage I don't think many of you read. It's not usually one of the favorite church passages on a Sunday morning. And God knows we don't read it very often in the synagogue, but we do every year, because we do everything every year. Sort of compulsive about that. Deuteronomy 25, verse 5. Y'all have it? 25, verse 5. Look at the shoes here.
When brothers reside together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her, taking her in marriage and performing the duties of a husband's brother to her, and the firstborn whom she bears shall succeed to the name of the deceased brother, so that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. But if the man has no desire to marry his brother's widow, then his brother's widow shall go up to the elders at the gate and say, "My husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel, He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of this town shall summon him and speak to him. If he persists, saying, I have no desire to marry her, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, pull his sandal off his foot, spit in his face, and declare, this is what is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. Throughout Israel, his family shall be known as the house of him whose sandal was pulled off.
How many of you read that before? How many remember that passage, right? What did you think of it when you first read it? Michael, what did you think of it when you first read it? You put up your hand, so I'm taking advantage of this moment to seek your wisdom, okay?
Well, I was doing this in a context of talking about how understanding of marriage and family has changed in terms of the course of biblical times, and again this sense of perpetuating the family name and everything there, and the thing that I noted and pointed out is that this is one of the and maybe even the only place, I don't know about that, where one of the responses is that you spit in someone else's face, which is, again, quite an insult.
Isn't that
an act of violence?
Yes, that's interesting. And just for your, you know, you're the only one who's interested in this, obviously, in this whole world. But you and I, because the spitting, that troubled the rabbis, too. And you know what? What does it say about spitting? Read the passage. You've read it before. There was somebody back here who has said, "How do you use it?" And then I'll give it. I'll go a little further.
I just was interested in this for a historical reason because Henry VIII's divorce relied on this passage somewhat.
It did indeed, isn't it?
Yeah, 1666.
Henry VIII, very fascinating. Fascinating story, and my mind works in ways that compel me to comment on that, because that played a role in his divorce. You know, Henry VIII divorced Catherine of Aragon, right? And Henry VIII had been a great supporter of the Roman Catholic Church. And he assumed, a little historical sideline, he assumed that he would have no trouble getting divorced because of the whole issue of indulgences was something, if you wanted a divorce, you would send money to Rome, and if you were the king, you would be able to get a divorce. He couldn't do it, and that's what created you all, starting with the Church of England, right? It started with you. But the story behind that is so fascinating, which the pastors here undoubtedly know, that the divorce was blocked by Philip, King Philip of the Holy Roman Empire, who was the great support of the papacy. And Henry VIII thought he would have no trouble because he had been a very, very prominent supporter of the Pope, and he thought this would be no problem. It was one little catch. You know what it was? Remember? Catherine of Aragon was the aunt of Philip, King Philip of the Holy Roman Empire. And that stopped it. How often religious things get tangled up in the politics of the day? Little side story, but it's a fascinating side story. All right, any other comments about Yabamot? We call it the marriage of one to one's brother-in-law. Yes.
Not as much as the feet are often a euphemism for the genitals, and this is a case where the brother-in-law won't perform. I'm figuring it's a highly symbolic.
That's very interesting.
Revelation.
That's very interesting. But I started to comment to Mike about the spitting in the face. There is a rabbinic commentary
that said, well, read the literal words. Michael, would you, you have the text there, the literal words for spitting in the face. How do you, what does your text say?
It just says, pull his sandal off his foot, spit in his face, and declare.
Ma Bean says, spit in his face. If you read the words, the Hebrew, literally, it means spit in his presence. Not into his face, but before his face, so that he can see what you were doing. All right. But here's an entirely different use of the word sandal than in our text. I want to take two more examples, if I can, very briefly, just to show you how the shoe plays a part. If you will, turn to Amos chapter 8, verse 6. Amos chapter 8, verse 6. I can't tell you what page, because all of our Bibles are a little different. They even arranged them. You won't believe this. We all use the same. We all use the same Hebrew Bible, but the what you I wish you wouldn't, but you do. You call it the Old Testament. For me, it's very much alive.
We call it the Hebrew Scriptures.
The Hebrew Scriptures. We call it the Tanakh, the Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, the Torah, the prophets and the writings, and we abbreviate those three words, Tanakh. And that's what we, but turn please to Amos, and somebody, our reader.
Verse 6.
Yeah. Amos.
Chapter 6, which one?
Chapter 6, chapter 8, verse 6. Chapter 8, verse 6. You're right, yeah, that's all right.
Okay. Buying the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals.
And Amos, that's enough. I don't want you to get tired. What Amos is condemning practices of the rich, and what do they do? Read it again.
Buying the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals.
In other words, they're buying slaves and needy people for the price of a pair of simple sandals. People are put into slavery. One more now, and then I'm going to ask you what these passages about shoes could have in common. Please look at Ruth, the book of Ruth, chapter 4, verse 7. Our reader of the day is going to lead us in an exalting and exhilarating trip through Ruth 4, verse 7.
247. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one took off a sandal and gave it to the other. This was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the next of kin said to Boaz, "Acquire it for yourself," he took off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "Today you are a witness that I have acquired from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth, the Moabite, the wife of Mahlon, to
that's
be
it.
My wife."
That's it. Now, how do you like that?
For a
pair of sandals. I have sold the needy for a pair of shoes, and I bought Ruth for a pair of sandals. Okay. Ruth is my wife, for those of you who don't know it. And she will not let me take off my sandals in her presence without washing my feet rather carefully. What do these passages have in common? Do you see anything that they have in common? Pamela, what do you see? Anything? You look so intelligent. I was going to. I knew you had that look.
Sandals are of value.
Sandals are of value, right?
But is that all you see, or is there anything else?
Sandals are the body. Just as one sandal of Moses was body.
Yes.
Yeah. Buying a person with the sandal implies the that person.
Okay.
And the sandals for Ruth is for a person.
The sandals are a symbol of giving, in the sense of, in Boaz, giving his sandal is a symbol of giving himself to Ruth as a kinsman redeemer, providing, being willing to take his wife and providing her with a child. So I see sandal. It, I mean, there's two ways. If the person is not willing to give, then in the passage in Deuteronomy, the woman is allowed to take the sandal off.
Yeah.
Rebuke basically the person who's not willing to become a kinsman redeemer, but
very good. Very good.
That's what I see.
All right. Anything else?
One of the possibility in Islam to show the bottom of your shoes is a shameful thing. There's something about the dirty of the bottom of the shoes. And that makes sense in the sense of, with a lot of animals traveling the paths, the dirt was very dirty. And so the value of shoes is maybe to protect one from the dirty ground. So when God says, this is holy ground, this is different, now it's okay to take your shoes off.
You know, there are a lot of good ideas in what you've just said. A lot of meat. And I'm not sure there's one answer to my question. That's why I dared to call on you, Pamela. I'm sorry to put you on the spot. But I'm seeing shoes in some. Anyone else want to come in?
I was thinking it was a sign of a contract. I mean,
it is obviously a sign of a contract.
And we talked about, or 100 years ago, people talked about a handshake as good as a contract. Uh-huh. This is kind of the contract.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. There was someone else.
I see shoes as being a kind of protection, not just what this gentleman up here was saying, but a protection from rocks and things that can hurt us. And when I take off my shoes and surrender them to somebody else, it's a way of making myself open and vulnerable to that.
I like that too. I like that. That's very good. Yes.
They're real important. Like when we had the parade last week, the carpenters were going to take off their shoes and walk down the middle of the street, and it didn't feel too good.
It didn't feel too good.
And in the Civil War and back then.
You know, Peter, what I wanted to do during, we had a July 4th parade here that was magnificent. And they made me Moses. They made me ride in a motorized scooter. So I had the vision of Moses in the year 1400 BCE riding his motorized scooter across the Red Sea. But what I wanted them to do, and Peter wouldn't do it. He was the main culprit, I think. I wanted them to turn on the water. You see, I wanted the, and as I passed by, I wanted the water to go off. That didn't quite. I couldn't pull that off. See.
The other thing I was thinking of, if in war times or times of conflict, you were 1-to-1 and you had the advantage on the enemy, instead of killing him, you could have him take off his shoes and you take his boots, because pretty much he was disabled then.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're so important, you know.
Anyone else?
I think if you go adding on to that, back then the ability to provide medical attention, you could be pretty much incapacitated if your feet were hurt severely,
it was a protection. That's good too. I like all of the things you've said. I'm just thinking of, in my own mind, what the strands are that are connected to this and how it's so central to the Moses story. It seems to me that in the sandal references that we have, a contract is involved. And something new is involved. I mean, the contract is, in the case of Ruth, that by taking off his sandals, Boaz is taking on the responsibilities of Ruth's former husband, of Ruth's family. Because after all, Ruth is Naomi's daughter-in-law, remember, who is gone with Naomi and followed Naomi into Canaan, into Palestine, and where she meets Boaz, and this contract is established. In the Yibamite marriage, as we call it, the marriage where the brother has to raise the family, raise a family for his widowed wife, he is preserving the name of the family, of his brother's family, so that the brother may inherit legally the property that belongs to his brother. So they would, in other words, it was sort of a woman's protection act. It would not leave the widow without property, without protection. And then I asked myself, what does this have to do with Moses? What does it have to do with this traumatic moment of Moses, which is, after all, the climax of our story? Moses is in the wilderness. He's been reduced to the simplest, I won't say the lowest life possible, because certainly in Judaism and in Christianity, the idea of the shepherd is an exalted one. But isn't it amazing that it is exalted because it is so lowly? It is exalted precisely because it's the thing. If you want to become a millionaire, you're not going to be a shepherd. If you're going to want to have dominion over people, you don't become a shepherd. It is the antithesis of power and of possession. It is the antithesis of the things we think of when we think of might, when we think of realm, of lord, of rule. It is everything. Here is, and I'm going to now take this because I see we're running a little out of time, and I don't want to leave you breathless, those of you who are catching the bus in a few moments with unfulfilled anticipation, because I think it's important to point out how Moses has been reduced to absolutely nothing. He takes his sheep to the furthermost end of the forest, of the wilderness. And even there, we can't agree on why he's at the furthermost end of the forest. One commentator says it's because of a social reason, that he wants to not hurt anybody else. He has this consciousness. He doesn't want his sheep to graze on anybody else's land. Now remember, the only thing that's qualified him for anything at all is that he's prevented a man from being killed by himself engaging in an act of violence. Now that's not a very good qualification for religious leadership. And another commentary says Moses took his flock to the very end, and you know, this little passage that most of us would ignore, that he took his flock to the end of the wilderness. Most people don't even read that. They don't even pay attention. He was where would you take your flocks if not into the wilderness or up the mountain? That's where they are. But the other commentary says, no, Moses didn't take it there for social reasons. He took it there for spiritual reasons. He wanted to meditate. He needed to get as far away from everything, from civilization, as he possibly could. So he goes out into the wilderness. He's there, meditating, and alone, far away. But then he comes, sees a bush burning. Now, lots of people saw that bush. But that bush is, in a sense, a contract. He doesn't realize it yet. It's a contract with God that he's about to make. How amazing that this idea of the shoes, and in order to enter into the contract, he has to take off his shoes. But this contract is unlike any other contract anyone has ever been engaged in. Because it's not a contract to take over Jethro's anything. It's not a contract to help his brother-in-law. It's a new contract with God. It is the beginning, ladies and gentlemen, of the new covenant that begins with an act of nakedness. It begins with Moses standing before God almost with symbolic nakedness. He has taken off his shoes. And it starts now with Moses having to say, look, there's something absolutely magical, something strange about this place. In other words, the holy, the sense of the holy, starts with the recognition that there's a possibility. I mean, you have to participate. You have to be in a contract, this is said. You have to be partners. It's not that God just comes to Moses. Moses has to, what's the word? What does he say? He has to turn aside. He has to do that. He has to do it himself. I mean, God can't say, hey, Moses. He'll say that in a minute. But just as Abraham went up to the mountain seeking something, so Moses is out in the wilderness, and there's something that catches his attention, a flame, a brightness, an idea. Take the flame as a new idea, the idea of the holy. It's holy. Now, you know, fire is not necessarily holy. Fire can be destructive. It can burn things down. It can destroy. This place was terrified last August, as you know, by a fire. It can be a very terrible thing when fire is out of control. But here's this one little bush burning. There's something unusual about it. It doesn't burn. It doesn't burn up. And Moses turns aside, gets closer. You know, that's the second step. You have to come closer. You have to come near. You can't be distant. You can't say, I'm going to sit back and see what happens. You've got to be a participant. Moses comes near. And then the contract becomes apparent. God will be God, and Moses will be the servant of God. What God means, we don't know yet. I'm not sure in the 21st century we know what God means. I'm going to try and deal with that during the next day or so. What can God mean? But what does this experience mean? Well, I can tell you this much right now, that it starts out by God's voice being heard. But look at how it happens. And on this, I'd like to end today's session. Look at how it happens. Amazingly, take a look back in your Exodus story of this incident. Exodus 3, verse 2 now. And our distinguished reader will lead us through these verses which we've read before. 3, verse 2. Moses is standing in Mount Sinai. Bush burns. Go ahead.
There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush. Moses, Moses, he said, here I am. Then he said, come no closer.
Okay. Take off your shoes. Now, have you noticed anything? There's a little thing here that I want you to notice before we adjourn for the day. Just a little thing. A little contradiction. Or maybe a little addition. Let's see if anyone can. What have you picked it up? You had your hand up. What is it?
Well, I was just noticing in verse 2 it says that he looked and the bush was blazing. And then in verse 3, he says, I must turn aside and look at this great sight.
Okay. Interesting. What? All right, that's very interesting. And what do you see? Why do you see that as significant? Because
he's already done it.
Okay, well, that's one thing. What else do you see? Yes.
I always think I must turn aside implies that he had his will set on a particular course of action.
Yeah.
And he has chosen to relinquish that will and redirect his attention and will to the presence of God.
Okay. All right, what else? What else do you see? Yes.
In verse 2, it's the angel of the Lord appeared to him, and then in verse 4, it's God called him.
Thank you. That's what I was getting at. That's what I'm very astute. And I hate to tell you, as brilliant as you are, you're not the first person to have noticed.
Just because he's on a sabbatical.
Okay. And the commentators pick this up and they say, what starts out is there's a sign from God, an angel. It's the angel who speaks to Moses at the beginning. Very interesting. In verse 2, it's the angel of God calls to Moses. And then Moses turns aside. In other words, there's a symbol of God, a representative of God, not God, 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 God self. Not God. But sort of something that reminds him of God. And that's what angels do. You know, just as Gabriel saved Moses when he was a little infant from touching the crown, sort of something, some aspect of God, something godly, some impulse, some whether it was an impulse or an urge or an actual angel. You know, it's not important what we call it, but something happens. Then Moses turns aside, takes off his shoes, reduces himself to the barest possible way in the wilderness, standing alone before a bush, a little thorn bush, not a lofty sequoia. He's not before the great mountains. He's in the simplest, most boring, most uninteresting place possible. And because he has entered into this contract with God, the Bible tells us, and God said, Moses, Moses, the call comes direct, becomes clear. And as we'll see, alas, ladies and gentlemen, Moses still doesn't know what to do with it. But that's the next chapter. Thank you.